I was just watching a YouTube video.
Yeah, what about what?
It was a guy making stuffed waffles out of mashed potatoes.
Shut up. Can I imagine without you? Just let me. Can I imagine? Try and explain.
Yes.
Okay.
Please. I want to hear what you think. About
easy.
That.
Take a waffle iron. Use an offset spatula to press mashed potatoes into the bottom. Then you put something delicious like pulled pork on top of it. A little bit more mashed potatoes with the palette knife, and then close the waffle iron, and you have meat inside of a potato waffle. Is that it? Did I get it?
I mean,
but there's an egg.
That would be one way to go about it.
Okay.
But imagine trying to get the mashed potatoes out of the waffle iron after you've done what you just described.
Well, what if it's a mix like Duchesse potatoes or
Lorette
potatoes?
Now
so it's like
now you're right on top of it. Yeah.
Mashed potato with egg yolk or mashed potato with, what am I trying to say? Shoe paste or something mixed up and then pushed in. Okay.
Yeah, so it's mashed potatoes bound with flour, eggs, and cheese.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think he put some green onions in it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then he took an offset spatula and squished some into the bottom of the waffle iron.
Right.
And then he put a piece of cheddar cheese on top of the potato batter. And then he put a piece of back bacon on top of the piece of cheese, and then another piece of cheese, and then another layer of waffle batter, and then he closed the waffle iron.
Mm-hmm.
Looked pretty tasty, honestly.
And sorry, this was on YouTube or on TikTok?
It was on YouTube.
Sure it was.
Yeah, I watched most of the cooking videos I watch are on YouTube. Sometimes I'll see a video on TikTok and I'll get inspired buy it, and then I'll go look for
inspired
additional content on YouTube, because most of the TikTok cooking videos are not very descriptive or very long, or you know, they're more just like showing off some surprising technique that somebody's discovered or something hilariously like
over the top. Yeah,
some kind of
two things. First of all, have you seen the meme? No, I don't watch TikTok videos. I watch them 2 weeks later on Instagram, like an adult.
No, I haven't seen that meme, but that's real.
Yeah. That's you and me. And then second of all, you literally sent me a link to a TikTok food video like 3 days ago.
Oh, did I? Which one? I don't remember.
I didn't watch. Just kidding. No, I did. I'm just kidding. It was, I didn't have the sound on, but it looked like a squid being pressed into a crepe.
Oh yeah, that was crazy.
Why did you send that to me? That was
Because I've never seen anything like that. That was madness. I couldn't believe it. Did you watch it?
Well, I said a squid getting pressed into a crepe. Obviously I watched it, right? Or
yeah, except it's more like a cracker.
Yeah, sorry, that's true. I was thinking actually, my mind went to the style of press that they use is like a corn tortilla press, like when they shape the raw masa and stuff. But it's like much bigger. It was like what, probably 2 feet square two feet by a foot and a half square maybe
something like that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And like a tortilla press, it had a way of like applying pressure.
Yeah,
but like unlike a tortilla press, like you screw this thing down with like a ton of pressure, and it basically just like squashes whatever you put in there into just like a paper thin sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this guy takes like a whole squid that's been cleaned and then puts it in the press and kind of spreads it out so that its legs are like sticking out in all directions, and then takes a little bit of like, crepe batter or something and sort of like fills in the gaps around the legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he like cinches down this press using this, like basically like it's like the kind of handle that you see on like a pressure door in a submarine or something. It's just like,
right.
It's like screws the grill down, and it's like looks like it's hot on top and hot on bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, yeah, it just squishes this octopus into like a paper thin cracker, and then he takes it out and hands it to this person, and they walk away with this like, yeah, 2 foot but on a side like squid cracker. Mm-hmm. And they're like walking away, and they like crack it in half, and it just like the squid just like cracks in half like a cracker. It looked crazy. Never seen anything like that.
When you saw the money shot at the end, did you want to eat it?
I mean, yes, but you know, not because I was like, oh my God, that looks delicious, but just like, I'm fascinated by what that must be like.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It was intriguing. It didn't look particularly delicious to me at the end, just like texturally, like it was just completely glassy, brittle, like,
yeah.
I mean, I would try it, but...
I mean, I hear you. Yeah, I just would want to try it. Like, I don't know, and the guy probably wouldn't have a stand by the side of the road and be selling them if people didn't enjoy it, so I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Or something. I don't know. Maybe he normally makes other kinds of food in that weird cracker press that he's got.
He might have opened...
Once a day, he gets a customer who's like, I want a squid cracker. And he's like, all right.
He might have opened that day, and that person just went that day because they're like, this sounds dumb.
First person in the history. Yeah.
Or maybe it's been a 2,000-year tradition in Japan. I have no idea, but it looked... No idea. It was, yes, it was surprising.
Anyway.
So yeah, thanks.
Super surprising, crazy. I'll put a link to the video in the show notes. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my friend Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. And tonight, Alan, do we have any feedback, follow-up? What do we call it? Follow-up.
Old news. No. Well, I watched the rest of The Bear, the first season
great.
Of The Bear.
Well, that's follow-up that will roll into a whole episode of
the show.
A whole
other podcast.
Yeah. That'll have to be 2 weeks hence, I guess.
At the earliest, yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear what you have to say about it, though.
But yeah, nothing else for me.
Yeah, I guess I don't have much follow-up. Aside from that, I haven't really, like, since... So, because of our recording schedule, it hasn't actually been 2 weeks since we recorded the previous episode.
Right, it's been 1 week? I can't even remember now.
Yeah, like a week and a day or so. Yeah. And during this past week, I've barely touched my wok. I barely did like any like real cooking at home. I don't know. I guess I fell off my...
You reached the end of the
intense rabbit hole or something, or I don't know. I don't know what happened, but I did go away to Canmore for 3 days this weekend. So that was part of it for sure.
Yeah,
I was like getting ready for
pictures.
That. And yeah. I went on a really nice hike. From Lake Louise up to this other lake called Agnes. Mm-hmm. And they have a little tea house up there. It's like a pretty famous hike that people do when they go to Lake Louise. That was really nice.
Did you eat at the tea house?
No, there was a lineup for tea, and I was just like, people come walk up a mountain to get in a queue to...
Well, like, okay. No, thanks. That's how I've thought about it. Like, growing up in Calgary and kind of knowing the Rockies scene, the tea houses were always weird to me. But I recently read a book called Alpine Cooking by Meredith Erickson, who is associated with the Joe Beef people, possibly married to Fred Morin. I'm not actually sure about that.
Okay.
But like, she was one of the co-authors of the Joe Beef cookbook, and she wrote a book on solo called Alpine Cooking that is about like the little restaurants that are in the Alpine regions of France, Austria, Switzerland, and Northern Italy. And it like totally enchanted me because I've been to I've been to those regions in Switzerland and Austria, and not really, I got a taste of some of that food, but not like the little taverns that you have to ski to kind of thing. But,
right.
she does such an amazing job of like, it's not just a recipe book. It's like the whole, the culture and history of it. It's really, it's a gem. Check it out.
Yeah, that's cool. And like that, the book sounds super cool. And it's super cool that like there is a little tea house up by this tiny lake that's like, I don't know, like 700 meters in elevation or 700 feet in elevation, like above where Lake Louise is, which is already like way up a mountain. Like, I mean, it's really cool that someone, you know, built the infrastructure and brought all of the materials and, you know, did everything to put this little, like little tea house in this cute little lake. Like, I think that that is enchanting and romantic and amazing and super interesting. But like the reality now is that like you go on this beautiful hike and then you get up to this beautiful picturesque little lake and there's a lineup for a Starbucks, you know, like it's just like,
is that what you equate the offerings to? And that's a serious question. Is that what it's like?
I honestly didn't even look at the menu. I was just like, I'm not really interested. You know, like there was a lineup and, you know, like you could, and it was just, you know, it was a similar scene, you know, like somebody's managing the lineup and telling people where to order. And, you know, I imagine that the offerings were quite limited and I don't think they had any food. I think they only had probably tea or coffee or something like that. So. Not entirely sure. Maybe they did have like some, maybe they did have some snacks and sandwiches or something like that. But I just got up there and wanted to take pictures of the lake and hang out for a
bit. But imagine an alternate reality where you are skiing at Nikiska and you go to the very top chair and a third of the way down the run, you can stop and have schnitzel. That sounds nice, doesn't it?
Sounds great. Totally. Or like, imagine like, when I was in the Cinque Terre, there was like this beautiful like hiking path that went between two of the towns and it goes up like back up into this hill and there's like a tiny little wine bar up there. Like, you know, basically has to provide its own infrastructure and stuff. Like, you know, it's a really cool idea. But yeah, like in the case of Lake Louise and the case of Lake Agnes, wasn't what I was after.
Great.
And I think that there, when I was hiking down, a guy, I went up there with my brother and a guy walked past us with like two, like kind of heavy looking pails that he was carrying down.
Carrying
which
down.
Is pretty crazy. Yeah. He was carrying down.
So it was like a to-go order of tea. Just kidding.
So I asked him, well, what do you have there? And he is like, oh, it's like garbage that needed to be carried out from like one of the tea houses. And I was like, oh, like from the tea house at Lake Agnes. And he's like, no, there's another one that's like kind of further up the trail. And I was like, oh,
that's where the cool hikers
that's the
go.
Real, yeah, exactly. That's the real alpine destination. And if I had known that, then I don't know, I may have planned things differently. But yeah, like, I mean, it's pretty crazy. Like they have to, obviously they have to carry everything in and, like, maybe during certain times of the day or certain days, like, and there are horses that go on those trails. So maybe sometimes they pack things in on horses or like, I don't know, like off-road vehicles or something. But, but yeah, like basically have to carry up the supplies and carry down the garbage is how it works.
Yep.
So that's pretty, it's a lot. It's a lot of logistics. I have worked in restaurants that are like I worked at Moraine Lake and it was in the park and there were a lot of really strict things that we had to follow in terms of, you know, how we dealt with our waste and stuff like that. And it was, you know, it was a little bit challenging, but yeah, we, you know, trucks could get up there and, you know, could come in daily if needed. So yeah, it wasn't logistically that crazy, but yeah. Having to carry every piece of ingredient up a mountain, you really start to dig into the efficiencies of, you know, how to use every single thing that you bring up there and try to waste as little as possible. And, it's interesting. So, well, we kind of have like an outdoorsy thing to talk about again, hey?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The plan.
Yeah, cool.
The plan is to talk about Cook's Camp 2022.
Yeah. Alan's second wild cooking adventure that we didn't quite have time to get to in the last episode.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So Cook's Camp is a, I guess, an annual conference. I don't know. I think it was maybe interrupted during the pandemic, but
okay.
A conference that's put on by the Chef's Table Society of British Columbia, which I
had seen a bunch of stuff pop up on my social media about it previously.
Oh, was there about the conference or about the Chef's Table Society?
About the conference. In previous years, I think.
So yeah, open to all, but definitely like a very much a British Columbia chefs kind of scene. But the purpose of the event is just to kind of foster camaraderie in the hospitality industry and to discuss, like, especially now with a lot of issues in the industry, like just talking about the future of food service operations and trying to figure out a way forward in a lot of different areas, but say like in terms of mental health and also like the financial realities and things like that. So yeah, it's it takes place on a farm just outside Pemberton, British Columbia. It's called North Arm Farm. So up the, like out of Vancouver, up the Sea to Sky Highway past Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some accommodations in Pemberton, but they also just like open up one of the fields on the farm for folks to camp in. So that's what I did. It's like basically a 2-day affair. And I flew into Vancouver and drove to Pemberton and camped out for a couple nights, and yeah, that's what we're gonna talk about.
That's what we're gonna talk about.
Yeah,
cool. Yeah, I guess there's a lot to dig into there, but
I can give you some more broad strokes.
Yeah.
So, like,
do you have a plan for how you want to talk about it?
The way it's been a process to unpack everything. It was a lot to take in over the 2 days, and I've had some time to digest, but if I can give you one some high level descriptions. First of all, it was attended, I don't actually have numbers like from the organizers, but I would say like for most of the time there was, in terms of attendees and presenters and all, there was usually about 100 people there. And they represented a pretty broad section of hospitality, mostly in back of house. It was definitely more of a, it tended to be people in independent shops.
Right.
Lots from Vancouver, lots of cool shops from smaller places in BC, like Port Moody and Kamloops and elsewhere. There was some pretty big names there for me. Like there was chefs from Vancouver that my main insight into the restaurant scene in Vancouver is this book called Vancouver Eats. And there was lots of people who like restaurateurs and chefs in that book who were there, like Angus Ann from Mame and Alex Chen, and I don't know, just like a lot of folks who are profiled in that book were at the conference.
Cool. Were they there to speak or were they there just to hang out for like the weekend or
both? Yeah. Some as presenters and some to hang. The keynote speaker was Normand Laprise, the chef owner of Toquet, which we'll talk about later. But there was also like what I would call like entry-level cooks. There was culinary school instructors like myself, a couple from SAIT as well, from Calgary. It was a cool, a diverse cross-section of industry. And the kind of the sessions that were offered, it wasn't really like characterized this way, but if I had to describe them, they kind of broke into three categories.
Okay.
there was ones that were like basically like culinary interest pieces, like things that are really food focused that are interesting, but they're also just a way for people to like interact and talk about food. Like things like they had foraging walks around the farm to talk about like local wild plants and mushrooms and such. They had actually on one of the first sessions was they did a lamb slaughter. Like they killed a lamb and showed how it's dressed and broken down. They had the owner of Acadian sturgeon and caviar do a sturgeon cutting demo and a caviar tasting. Kevin Kent from Knifeware was there to talk about knife selection and stuff like that. So it was like, to me, all of that was really interesting. It was kind of stuff that like I had seen before in Alberta. Mm-hmm. Really interesting, but like, yeah, in a way, the benefit of it was like the networking part, like just like talking about food with really knowledgeable people. And so that was one piece of it. And then they had other sessions that were really like focused on mental health and wellness in industry.
Was that sort of like the theme of this year's incarnation of Cook's Camp, or
I think that's
that
an ongoing,
just sort of like an ongoing?
I think so. Yeah, with Chef's Table Society and with this conference specifically, I think it's something that's talked about year over year for sure. I think actually, like the main presentation that comes to mind in this category was by someone named Johnny Bridge. I think that he was like invited back because in one of the online incarnations of the conference, his talk had been one of the most like asked about in the year previous. So he came to talk about, there's a group, I don't know if it's like a part of the Chef's Table Society or not, but it's called Mind the Bar, and they have an app called LifeWorks.
Okay.
That is specifically for, I guess, like managers in industry to help staff who are having mental health or other crises, like get the help they need. And it's actually a lot broader. Like when folks say like a mental health crisis, to me, my mind jumps to like depression, anxiety, and addiction. Those are the big ones that I think of, especially related to hospitality, but it was actually much broader than that. And so they were talking about like one of the, if you just kind of survey people about like sources of stress, anxiety, and whatever else, like couples counseling was one that came up the most. And so this LifeWorks app like can put people in touch with couples counselors and financial advisors and like lawyers if you're going through a divorce or something like that. So a really broad like offering of support there. And it's like,
that's cool. Maybe we can dig into it more specifically after the broad strokes or something.
Yeah, totally. And then the last category of session was what I would call like, basically like food service operations issues specific to this point in time.
Right.
To me, that was the most interesting, like, and I got the most like a kind of glimpse that I might not have got elsewhere, but like talking, like seriously talking about things like the insane rising cost of goods and the very, especially in BC, the labor shortage, the labor crisis, whatever you want to call it, which is especially acute in hospitality. So yeah, it was there for two nights camping, attending these sessions, loads of great food. They were cooking all kinds of big kind of family meals over coals. And yeah, it was a lot to take in for sure.
That's awesome. So how did you find out about it / decide that you wanted to go / get invited, or what was that?
Basically my supervisor told me about it and suggested that go.
Sweet.
I hadn't heard of Chef's Table Society or the conference actually before, but he mentioned it. And honestly, especially hearing that Norman Laprise was the keynote, I was like, oh, that's a really great opportunity. It happened to work out really well with like the family and work
timing
stuff.
Wise.
So yeah.
Cool. Yeah. That's I had seen people post about it in previous years, and I don't exactly remember what that was, but yeah, I definitely had sort of been aware that it was happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't really have any information about it, but hearing you talk about it now, I'm kind of thinking maybe it's something I should think about for next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. So I guess, did you go on your own? Did you know anybody there? Like when you showed up? And
the only person who was there the only person who was there who I had met before was Kevin Kent, the owner of Knifeware, who was a presenter. Yeah. Everyone else who was attending or organizing, I had not met. No.
Had never met before. Cool. Was that weird? Was it intimidating?
Not really. It was like, it's a pretty welcome, like it's specifically designed to be like a welcoming and inclusive event. Right. Yeah. And especially, I don't know, like, I have almost no experience going to out of town conferences like that, but like, especially the first night that you're there, like you can walk up to anyone and ask them who they are and where they're from and what they're up to and stuff. Like it's a pretty casual and welcoming place. Yeah.
That's awesome. So the people that were cooking there, like, was everyone that was there providing food or providing meals or whatever, were they like paid by the conference to bring food up there and prepare it? Or were there lots of people who just wanted to come and like prepare something there so that they could show people? Mm-hmm. Or how did that work?
I have no idea how people were paid. If I remember right, most of the meals, like there was someone who came in to guide the ship and make the meal. There was like loads of opportunity for people to like, they said, if you want, like bring a knife and like expect to, if you want to pitch in, like do so.
Right.
But like, for instance, on, I think it was the first night of the conference, they had a chef named Brody Swanson from Haida Gwaii come in to specifically prepare a meal like that represents the indigenous cuisine of BC, like of Haida Gwaii specifically, but of BC generally. And there was one meal that was prepared or at least led by a team from Araxi in Whistler. But yeah, there was lots of people who were just, yeah, pitching in because it's fun. Yeah.
Cool. And like, let's say that, I don't know, let's say that you had some kind of meal or preparation that you really wanted to like show people or interact. Could you just like roll up with ingredients and do a food demo if you wanted to? Like,
I don't think they would give you your own breakout session to do that. Like they had like an itinerary, right? And all
like
that.
Like everything is like planned, and all the meals are planned and all the sessions are planned and everything. Yeah. Okay.
I think so.
Just like trying to get an idea.
Like I'm sure there's some element of fluidity in terms of like, if someone has, I don't know. Yeah. If someone shows up with something, but like for the meals, like it seemed like there was a group who was dedicated for each service and they brought in ingredients and you could come and help, mm-hmm. but like it. Yeah, they had a plan. There was right.
like catering. Or if someone from a winery went there and they brought like a case of wine and they just wanted to like hand it out to chefs or have chefs taste it, like would the, you know, like I guess that's what I'm sort of trying. Was there a lot of sort of like promotional stuff, cross promotion and things like that going on, or was it mostly just like the planned sessions and the networking? And
I don't know. Like, I don't have a good glimpse into the behind the scenes, but like, for instance, there was the owner of a kind of butcher shop and charcuterie in Kamloops. And I know that his products were one of the offerings for dinner one night. I don't know if that was like a impromptu thing. Like he just like showed up with salami and stuff and said, hey, you guys can put this on the spread, or if it was
right.
But it wasn't like none of it came off as like a, like going to a large food and wine event where there's like huge like sandwich boards that like say the name of the restaurant and what they're providing right. you. Like it was much, much more casual and down to earth than that. Does that make sense? What I just said? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like you're talking about like where you go to like, I don't know, like a trade show or
yeah, like Rocky Mountain
food and wine show in a city and everyone has a booth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You go up.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't like that at all. Thing or it was much lower key and like, yes. Yeah.
Cool. So, you arrive, you fly in, what, you rented a car, I assume?
Mm-hmm.
You drive up there, you arrive, what, like in the afternoon of the first day and sort of like
around
set
lunch,
up
yeah.
camp? Around lunch, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, walk me through that.
Beautiful drive. I'd never been there before.
Oh,
like,
man.
Never
it
done
is
that
a beautiful
drive.
Beautiful drive, yeah.
Apparently before the Olympics, that was called the Highway of Death, but now it's... very
now it's no longer called that
picturesque and very safe
okay
and yeah that was
I actually haven't driven it since the Olympics so.
Oh is that right okay
I don't think so yeah
and yeah onto the farm and directed to the field and set up my tent and walked to the kind of welcome center and yeah like I said before very like a very welcoming place. One of the organizers like said hi and asked where I was from. And I was like, oh, I'm from Edmonton and from Nate. And she's like, oh, you have to meet this other Albertan. And it was an instructor from SATE named Michael Allemeyer, who's actually not the what I just said makes us sound like peers, but he's a master chef. Where there's only like five,
oh, cool.
I think there's five in Canada. And he's mm-hmm. one of them. So she introduced me to him. That was cool. But then, yeah, like I said, that first night, you can walk up to anyone and start a conversation. So
cool. And was Norman Laprise there that first night? And did you walk up to him and be like, hey, how's it going?
I think he was there the first night. And no, I didn't walk up to him. I probably could have, but I didn't. But yeah, he was generally present. He was on site as far as I could see
like the whole
time.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
I have met him once before, very briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
When I was working at Noma, he came for dinner there.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's awesome.
And because I was like, I think the only or maybe one of two chefs from Canada. No, I think I was the only Canadian there at the time. And so they like had me run food to his table and
is
told
that true?
Him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I told him that I was from Canada. And then when he came on the kitchen tour, I kind of was sort of like guiding him through the kitchen and like kind of like was like their go-to for.
They don't know anything about Canadian regional dynamics, obviously.
No, it's exactly like somebody asking you if you know Steve from Steve from Canada or whatever. It was really funny. Yeah. And we were both kind of like, I think we both thought it was kind of humorous.
I mean,
but I'm sure he doesn't remember it at all. But.
He's a very nice man and a very personable and friendly man, but like the idea that he would be enthused that someone from Alberta was bringing his food is kind of silly.
Yeah, it was really funny. And I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I think we were both able to appreciate the humor in it. I don't know. Maybe he would remember that.
I wish I had known that.
If I ever get to talk to him again, I'll ask him.
That would have given me an opening. I totally would have gone to him with that. To say, well, do you know Shale?
No. Do you know Shale
from
Canada?
Yeah, Shale from Canada. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Cool. So you arrived. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, maybe it's a bad idea. I was going to say, like, if we're talking about Norman Laprise, do you want to just go in? Because he was the keynote speaker. Do you want us to talk about that or should we build up to it?
Sure. No, yeah. Let's talk about that. So why was he there? What was he there to speak about?
Well, I didn't know beforehand, and I don't maybe okay. like to like a very brief background for listeners who don't know who Norman is. Like, he is a chef from Montreal, or sorry, who works in Montreal, and he's most famous for a restaurant called Toque, which is considered one of these kind of like watershed restaurants for Quebec gastronomy. The kind of like seismic shift sometime, I don't know, like in the 90s, I guess, where like the transition from an entirely like Eurocentric ingredients and viewpoint to like really focusing on Quebec producers, artisans, growers, and food history, like cuisine.
If I'm not mistaken, too, like it was also one of the very first Canadian restaurants to make it onto the San Pellegrino 50 top 50.
Oh, or is
top
that 100. Right? I wouldn't be surprised, yeah, but I don't actually know. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. But I don't really know where it ranked and when and
right.
what the sort of history is there. But yeah, I think it's one of the first Canadian restaurants to get named on the list. Mm-hmm.
And I think like a lot of the chefs who are considered like the faces of Quebec gastronomy went through his kitchen. Certainly Martin Picard, and I actually don't know, but I think Fred Morin as well. So yeah, he's been, I think on one of Bourdain's shows, he's called like the godfather of Quebec gastronomy.
Yeah. That's a lot of names. That's a lot of history. That's a lot of clout, but I think like, you know, it makes sense, you know?
Mm-hmm. So in terms of like, you ask like why was he the keynote? Mm-hmm. Like I knew his food and I haven't eaten at Toque or any of his brasseries or anything, but I have the Toque cookbook and like knew what their style of food was about.
Right.
And didn't really think about, but I expected that that's what he would be talking about. Wasn't really about that at all. It was primarily or kind of built to I guess collective that he helped found called La Table Ronde, the round table.
Okay.
That he didn't put again, I'm nervous about, I don't want to put words in his mouth. It's a collective.
I mean, this is your impressions, right?
Yeah, it's a
collective. Well, I guess you want to get be accurate about the,
right, yeah.
About the actual structure of the thing. Yeah.
He didn't put it this way, but it's a collective of independent restaurants that is basically doing what Restaurants Canada does, but for independent restaurants in Quebec. Okay. So Restaurants Canada.
So what does Restaurants Canada do?
That's a great question. And what? Restaurants Canada is a it's also a collective and I guess like a lobby group that it has a number of benefits for restaurant operators in Canada. Like there's kind of like bulk purchasing clout. There's actual lobbying efforts, especially with regards to I'm going to get way over my head here, but especially with regards to like labor regulations and things like that, like minimum okay. wages and that kind of issue, things like group insurance, promotion of the industry, that kind of thing. But okay. for La Table, that's Restaurants Canada. But La Table Ronde, specifically for independent restaurants in Quebec, and specifically for or one of the key issues is like the promotion of Quebec gastronomy. And Quebec as a destination for culinary tourism, agricultural tourism, and also interestingly, in my mind, one thing that like really distinguishes it from Restaurants Canada would be like La Table Ronde is like specifically one of their goals is to identify and promote niche artisans and producers to like. Okay. give them
like to promote them to restaurateurs so that their products can be utilized in the industry?
Like, and by way of the restaurants in the bigger centers, like promoting them to the public. But yeah, I think you're right. Like, promoting them so that the independent restaurants in Quebec have access to that kind of product. Right. And that was interesting to me because I can't remember what conversation it was part of, but like you made a comment about like the supply side of operating restaurants in Edmonton and how different it is from other larger centers and centers that have culinary mm-hmm. tourism as a big part of the scene.
Right.
And so a chunk of Normand's talk was about that, the history and the effort that he and other restaurateurs of that period in Quebec went through to foster the supply side in the province. Because when he came back from, he apprenticed in France, I think in Lyon in the 80s.
Oh,
came back to Quebec. And at that time, just like here, just like in Alberta, like everything was Eurocentric. And it was like, even like the produce would come from Europe because you couldn't get right. French carrots and French green beans grown in Canada. And obviously the wine all came from Europe. But he and others like him, they went to farmers in Quebec and started this dialogue. And a kind of, I don't think he put it this way, and I don't want him to seem condescending, but kind of like an education for them to say like,
right.
you know, I'm willing to pay this for this, but it has to be exactly this size and it has to be this quality and it has to be this variety. And like the kind of gastronomic or whatever, the culinary demands of fine dining.
Yeah.
And so he talked a bit about like he and others like him from independent restaurants, they did that groundwork and the benefits of it, like it fostered the rural economies of Quebec. It gave growers and like, whatever, cheesemakers, that kind of like, you know, cider makers, things like that. It gave them, it grew a niche market for them in Montreal and Quebec City. And it basically, I don't think he said this, but it basically invented culinary tourism in Quebec.
Crazy.
And the kind of point of the keynote was like, no one paid him to do that. And right now, the province, like Quebec has clout or repute in a way, like, you know what I mean? Like Bourdain did episodes there. Like it's seen as a culinary destination that was entirely grown by these entrepreneurs and independent restaurant owners and chefs and folks like that. And the province is reaping the benefits of it. But in his eyes, especially going through COVID, the independent restaurants had a much rougher go of it than the chains. And in terms of everything from support to taxes to whatever it is, he just felt like the independents needed to get together to stand up to protect what they have already done and get a fair shake going forward. So yeah, it was not the talk that I expected in a good way. It was like,
yeah,
it was eye opening. It left me with loads of questions that I'm still like trying to answer, like the specific things that like if you really get into the specifics, like how were the chains treated differently than the independents, say with COVID and shutdowns right. and things like that. Or
like I have a ton of questions too.
Yeah. So and I won't be able to answer half of them. I'm sorry, but
yeah, fair. No. Yeah.
Or the specific, like I listened to the talk. I've read the, La Table Ronde website, but like really what are the services that the collective offers for the members? And honestly, I don't know, Restaurants Canada, like I know of them and I kind of know what they do, mm-hmm. but that's another thing. Like I hadn't given much thought to, but Normand's talk had me on the Restaurants Canada website reading about their services. And it's actually a very, like, on a surface level, it's a very different tone. And I don't have stats for it, but like Restaurants Canada definitely is catered for owners and operators of chains.
That's what I was going to say. It sounds to me like when you talk about things like collective buying and stuff like that, it sounds like the type of thing that is, you know, more useful for chains to be involved with,
right,
than it is for independent restaurants. It's hard, like, to it's hard to logistically be a part of those types of things as an independent restaurateur.
Yes.
Just because you don't have a, you know, such a large, you know, like, you don't have so much buying power. And then also you tend to, like, what you are buying or how much of it you can buy and when tends to fluctuate a lot more than a chain, you know?
Yeah.
So I've had, you know, when I've been working at places, I've had people, you know, come and talk to me about joining, like, buying groups and things like that. And I don't know if any of them were associated with Restaurant Canada. I don't remember specifically. But, you know, like, after looking at the material, usually it hasn't really made sense for me to try to go forward with any of the proposals that I've seen, because it just seems like, you know, what they, because it's sort of like, you know, they expect you then to also, like, only buy through their suppliers and things like that. And there are a lot of stipulations, and it just hasn't usually made sense to go forward with something like that, because the stipulations don't make sense for the small business that I'm working for. So but like Le Table Ronde sounds like it's something that's supposed to kind of address those types of things for smaller independent restaurants, which is interesting. Is it like brand new after COVID? Le Table Ronde, like, is that, was that
it, its in the last I can't remember exactly what year, but it has been in the last 2 years that it was founded.
So it was like as a result of this realization or sentiment that Normand Lepreze was having about, you know, how it was tougher in Quebec for smaller or independent restaurants to make a go of it during the pandemic, and chains seem to have more support for the way that they're doing business.
That's the impression that I got from his talk.
And therefore he and some of his restaurateur friends decided to form this group.
That's the impression that I got. Anyways, regardless of the actual founding date, that, like, he specifically mentioned in his talk that COVID is what, like, kind of put the lights on to the disparity between how the groups are being treated. But my own, and this is, I'm saying this partly just so that I underline how little understanding and interaction I have with Restaurants Canada. But the only time that I've worked with it is at some point at Elm, we were pretty sure we could get a better deal on the cleaning supplies, like the detergents that the washing machine was that the dish machine was using. And so
this is like ringing a distant bell.
We had a quote from Diversey, and it was like, these are the prices, but if you're a member of Restaurants Canada, these are your prices. And so we were like, okay, fine, we'll sign up for Restaurants Canada. The annoying thing was that the prices were lower because of a rebate program. So, like, it wasn't lower on the surface. It was like, once you spend this amount of money, you'll get a rebate.
You get a kickback.
Yeah. And to be honest, like, I don't remember the specifics of it, but I definitely sat down with the owner of Elm and was like, we haven't got, like, we're not getting, this isn't working. Like, we're not getting the rebates because we're not buying on the quantity or whatever it is. However, because we had to sign up for Restaurants Canada, I was getting I was on the email feed. And what my memory is that, like, This was when the NDP had recently become the provincial government in Alberta, and they were one of their policies that they were elected on was to raise the minimum wage to $15. And so they started doing that because that's what they said they would do, and they were voted in. And the flood of like emails from Restaurants Canada saying stand up to the provincial government and don't let them raise the minimum wage was shocking. And like it whatever, that was problematic for food service operators in Alberta, obviously, but like it was, I thought it was pretty messed up. And that's not a one.
Yeah, that is messed up.
If you look,
I mean, obviously if you have to start paying all of your workers like $3 or $4 per hour more than they were being paid like a year or 2 years ago, like that's going to be an economic problem for your business. Mm-hmm. Like that goes without saying, but like, the bigger picture is that like everyone who is earning that wage isn't able to live off it, and the idea is to raise that so that everyone can at least have a hope of having a living wage. Mm-hmm. And man, like, yeah, small business owners who are against their employees being able to live off what they pay them, yeah, it just doesn't seems sustainable, you know. It seems weird.
It's a hard conversation, because I remember the wage increase in Alberta, and I remember like there's lots of independent business owners in Edmonton who like talked about it, went online, talked about the actual effects it was going to have on their business. Paul Schufelt comes to mind. But like this as a group, Restaurants Canada, like this is like one of their MOs is suppressing the minimum wage, and they're doing it right now.
I mean, yeah, when you said lobby group, that was the first thing that popped into my head. Yeah. And I was like, oh man, is that what we're going to wind up talking about?
Oh yeah, we're talking. Here we are. Yeah. It's happening like right now in Saskatchewan. The minimum wage is $11.80. So much less than it is in Alberta. I know it's a different economy and everything, but like it's $11.80. The government wants to raise it to $13. And like, if you go on Restaurants Canada right now, like you can see on their newsfeed, it's like Saskatchewan restaurateurs, you know, disgusted by the proposed blah, 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 whatever it is. But yeah, it's like a thing. And I don't like, whatever. I don't really understand all the economics, but on the one hand, picture this collective of BC chefs who are coming together to try and talk about the sustainability and longevity and wellness of their industry and the people who work in it. And then on the other hand, like look at the news feed of Restaurants Canada. I don't know, like I don't understand all the nuances, but that's what I left this conference thinking about.
Right.
A lot of the arguments, like Restaurants Canada will talk about that most of the entry-level employees in food service that are getting minimum wage, $11.80 in Saskatchewan, are kids who are living with their parents. And so it's like an introduction to the workforce. And so like, why do they need
is
to be
there also though a training wage in Saskatchewan? Because this is another thing that is like that has to do with how specifically like the hospitality industry has approached the problem of trying to suppress the minimum wage. And that's by having a training wage for people who are younger than 18 years old.
Oh, is that right? They had that in Alberta or?
That was a thing when I was a kid in Alberta. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a thing in Alberta anymore.
I don't think. Oh yeah. I feel like I've read the labor regs, but
I haven't read anything about it in the labor regs recently, but I don't know. I think I heard somebody say something about there being pockets of it in certain industries still recently. And I don't remember off the top of my head, so I shouldn't really try to talk about it. But yeah, like that was definitely a thing. And I wonder if it's still a thing in like Saskatchewan or, you know.
Well, definitely. We're just going to go off into a topic that you weren't prepared to discuss, but like just because it's in the regs doesn't mean that that's what's happening. You know.
Yeah, for sure.
And actually, one of the things that came up a lot that I had never heard of, but apparently was commonplace in Vancouver, and like the restaurant scene in Vancouver is very different than the restaurant scene in Edmonton, but apparently day rates were really common as a payment structure, which means that you're paid a set quantity for a day's work. And a day's work is you start at this time and you finish when we're done. So it could be a 12-hour day or whatever. But it's like you get paid $200 a day and you work from 10 a.m. until we're done.
Ooh, $200 a day, Alan. That's a lot.
Well, for a 12 or 16-hour day, though. Well, whatever. Sorry, I can't do the math that fast.
But for an 8-hour day,
that's true. It's a good deal. Well, yeah, if you leave at noon, then it's a great deal. But the I can't do the math that fast in my head. But like they were saying, like it was often, if you like stretch the pay over the hours, it was below minimum wage, so it was illegal.
Yeah.
But apparently, in Vancouver and other larger markets than Edmonton, that was very common. Like basically, after the 2008 recession, the way it was described in one of the panel discussions at the conference was that after the 2008 recession, so many high-end restaurants either closed or the chefs of those establishments moved to open their own like casual fine dining that was more like accessible to people in a recession.
Right.
They imported this labor model from fine dining, which was long hours, little pay, day rates.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know about you. Like I've never heard of a day rate model in Alberta.
Yeah. I worked in several restaurants in Vancouver and never encountered a day rate and never was paid a day rate. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it sounds like a restaurant thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, there are a lot of tricks that I think like a lot of employers in the service industry use to try and get around regulations, which, yeah, I mean, it just points to the fact that the economics of the industry in general are not really sustainable.
Yes. And that's, if I can, another takeaway, like what I found myself thinking and saying to myself after some of the discussions at the conference that weren't necessarily explicitly said during the, say, the presentations or the panel discussions, but the idea for me was that a lot of the, say, like cost control models or like models for accurately like calculating the cost incurred by providing the food and service, the models that have been inherited don't apply anymore or have kind of gone off course and need to be corrected or adjusted for our times now. The most obvious one is like the cost of goods, like just inflation, the price of food and gas and everything. Like for some reason, and this is, I feel like in a way, independent restaurants are kind of unique in this regard. They're so reluctant to raise the menu prices so that they can recoup cost of goods. Like it's crazy because there's no, like you think like Amazon's going to just like sell something to you at a loss because they're scared of what you'll think if it costs something different. Like it doesn't make any sense. Well, sorry, they do that sometimes. They do that. But
well, yeah. And like, I think kind of the problem there, the reason why that sentiment exists is because chains and fast food restaurants are, you know, very reluctant to change their pricing because it affects a lot of people and they will tend to get backlash. But because they have large buying power, they can effectively work deals where even though the cost of goods may be going up generally because of their buying power, they can try to suppress that for themselves. But that means that, like, that means additional inflation of the price for independent restaurants because they have, because the suppliers and the farmers and, you know, everyone else has to make up that difference somewhere, right? And so they may not be charging McDonald's more for potatoes, but they have to charge somebody more for potatoes because potatoes cost more for them to produce, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, it's sort of, I think in a lot of cases winds up being additionally inflated for independents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In those types of situations who don't have a lot of buying power.
There's a bunch, some of these will sound petty, but I think that like if you think about them in the aggregate, like it really paints this picture of the cost of doing business for an independent restaurant is not adequately paid for by the prices that they charge. But like something as simple as like doing a service on a holiday, mm-hmm. like in Alberta, and I assume across Canada, I don't know about the States, but like on a holiday, most of the employees are going to be getting time and a half for their hours. Mm-hmm. So your labor has jumped 50% for that one service. And sure, maybe you'll be a little bit busier because it's a holiday, but like that means you'll need more staff. So, but like, it's not a common practice. It does happen, but it's not a common practice, or it's not like a traditional practice in restaurants to boost all your prices on a holiday. But if it's a real business, that like what goes in needs to be paid for on the other end. Like, and actually someone mentioned in a conversation that they had made a reservation in, I think it was in Australia actually. And mm-hmm. they were notified like, this is a reservation on a holiday. And so you're going to have like, there's going to be a 10% surcharge added to your bill. Like whatever you spend $100 at the restaurant, you're actually going to be charged 110 because labor costs more on holidays. And that's, to me, that's the kind of thing that like, as a restaurant, sorry, I'm not a restaurateur, but like I can picture owners just like cringing at having to deal with the customers who are going to say, what? Why would, like, it's Monday. Like, why would I have to pay 10% more on a Monday or whatever? But like, that's the economic reality is like, you're, instead of your labor being 30% of sales, it's going to be 40. So like, what's the, you should charge for it.
Right. And but like, where do you think that like hesitancy comes from?
I think that, well, I mean, it's probably a natural human fear of confrontation and stuff like that. But it like, honestly, I think might be just rooted in the entire culture of dining out and the customer is always right. And I don't know. Is that, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that that's like, yeah, that's basically my thoughts on it too. I think that, I mean, I think it's a little more nuanced than that. Like the whole business is about trying to attract and please people with your hospitality and, you know, giving people a pleasant experience and something that they will want to come back for, mm-hmm. right? Like the whole hospitality business is built on trying to give people a good experience so that they'll come back and pay for it again. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's like a really, it's a really tough balance there in terms of presenting your customer with the economic reality of the business, because you don't necessarily want them to have to consider those things when they're making their decision about whether they should come to your restaurant or not, right?
Maybe that's the problem.
You want to make it as simple for them as possible to walk through the door, come in, sit down and have some food.
Yes.
You know, some of those things, parts of those things are like having consistent operating hours. Mm-hmm. You know, if customers know that your restaurant is always open from 10 until 10 every day, then they know that they can come in and get food whenever. Mm-hmm. And if they start showing up and you're only open from 10 until 5 and they didn't find out and it's because it's a holiday or it's because of whatever, then, you know, those are potential customers of yours that you're probably going to lose because you made it difficult for them to make the decision to come in and frequent your establishment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think the same thing applies to like pricing changes or price increases. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that like, and like, and so you have to ride that line, right? And I think that that's like for a smaller establishment or like, you know, a higher end establishment, I think communicating to your customers, like for one thing, like, okay, so a reasonable example is like the practice of taking Oh man, this conversation has gone way, way off the rails from you being at Cook's Camp.
You thought I was just like cooking eggs. I was sitting outside my tent cooking eggs with a bunch of chefs.
Where are we right now?
No, this is not where my mind went after the con. Like there was lots of great social stuff. There was lots of great food, whatever. I got to meet amazing people, but yeah, this is like what set my mind on fire when as I left. Anyways,
we'll get back to the other stuff, but anyway, I think a good example is the practice of restaurants that take reservations, taking a deposit on your credit card and charging you a deposit if you don't show up for your booking.
That was in my next example. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a reasonable thing to do. And it seems like something that the public has to some extent been willing to accept. I know a lot of people still complain about that. Absolutely, and especially a lot of people who don't necessarily dine out a lot and haven't really encountered it don't really understand why it's necessary. Mm-hmm. But it is necessary, and a lot of restaurants do it, and they just explain that to their customers, and I'm sure that they do take a hit on some, you know, like on some word of mouth that they would get or from like on people who leave bad online reviews because they got charged and they didn't even go to the restaurant. But you know, if you communicate it in the right way, then it's beneficial to your restaurant to do that, because you're going to lose less bookings, mm-hmm. and you're going to, you know, you're hopefully going to have a more stable night every night, mm-hmm. Which is very important. So yeah. And the idea of like charging a surcharge on a holiday, that makes a lot of sense to me. I've heard a lot of things about the restaurant industry in Australia that sound to me like they would make a lot more sense than maybe how things are in North America.
Oh, is that right? That's interesting. Which, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, over the course of my career, like talking to people who have worked there and just like what the structure is like there and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? There's no tipping.
Is that right? Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And also like, back of house jobs. I don't know if it's like they're all unionized or, but like there's a there's a much better sort of labor structure for how people get paid to work in restaurants, mm-hmm. From what I've heard.
I'm gonna look into that. So, cool.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I definitely think that there's a lot that needs to change in North America. I think that a lot of that has started to change because of COVID, but then there's also been a lot of like really negative change in the restaurant industry because of COVID, mm-hmm. as well. Like a lot of businesses that were forced to close their doors because they just couldn't make it work economically
staffing. And especially, you know, independents. Like the chains are fine.
Yeah.
Well, 7-Eleven's not. 7-Eleven closed a lot of locations. So is Starbucks, but they're probably doing just fine.
Yeah.
Can I?
I mean, it's like it's like they close a lot of locations, but it's kind of like
just drive-throughs now.
It's no skin off our nose. We'll just reopen them once we, you know, like it's they don't care about the people that it affects or whatever.
Can I just to put you on the spot?
Sure.
One more. I want to get your take on something.
Okay.
That's kind of related to what we're talking about now, and then we can move on to the rosy fun parts of the conference. But
okay,
so one of the panel discussions was moderated by a food writer named Corey Mintz, I think out of Winnipeg, but he has a book called The Next Supper. It has a really long subtitle, the End of Restaurants as We Knew Them and What Comes Next, or something like that. And I want to just read you a quote, and I want to get your hot take on it.
Okay.
Corey says, quote, "The customer is always right," end quote, "is a business axiom at odds and out of date with today's dangers and our broader understanding of consent, fairness, and equity." Do you want me to read it again?
No, I got it.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that it's true, to a certain extent. I, you know, like obviously it like evokes a lot of different potential questions and arguments. Mm-hmm. like each one of those things that he lists about what the dangers are in our modern society, about like what were the three things?
Consent, fairness, and equity.
Consent, fairness, and equity. Yeah, like all three of those words have a lot of sort of like societal implications right now, and sort of in different ways. And so it's a lot in one statement to sort of unpack.
On the spot, yep.
but like, I definitely think in some way it's true because of, I mean, I would say a large part of why those things are becoming, or those types of things need to be addressed now, is because of how we communicate on the internet, how we, you know, like how quickly awareness can spread about things, right, and how quickly misinformation can spread about things. And so because of that, you know, like I definitely feel like there are situations where the customer is not right, you know, and in some situations, I mean, I've seen situations where the customer is not only not right, but the customer wants to damage your business for reasons that are in some cases petty or, you know, don't, you know, like have any bearing in reality. And so I think that there's, I think there's a lot of truth in that statement, but like I was saying before, I mean, maybe like maybe the axiom needs to change. Like maybe the customer is always right is not the correct axiom, but there does still need to be a balance between like giving your customer what they expect or giving them more than what they expect and trying to please them as much as possible within the confines of like fairness and equity for your business. And so, yeah, I mean, I... the customer is always right has never been true, but you use it as a mantra to try and instill in the people that are working for your business that, you know, like that's
they're in the where, service, they're in the service of the,
like, and that's where the lifeblood of the business is in the customers that are willing to come and pay. And so it, it makes sense as like, as a mantra to try and help your employees and the other people that work for your business to help them try to understand that even in difficult situations where they may feel like their own needs are being put aside for the needs of a customer who maybe in that instance is treating them unfairly or something like that, it's just sort of like is an easy thing to say to give someone a tool to remember that, you know, they are there earning, you know, the business is earning money from that customer to put in their pocket. And so it pays to make the customer feel like they're getting what they want. You know, but it's, you know, it's always been more complicated. And I think that I, you know, I don't think that my view on that has changed much since I was a McDonald's employee when I was 14 years old. I mean, you know, when I was working for McDonald's when I was 14 years old and they told me that the customer was always right, I was like, well, yeah, but except but when they're not, though, right? Like, if the customer comes into the McDonald's and steals the hat off my head so that they can take it and wear it skateboarding, I mean, clearly that's not right.
I thought they bought it off you. Didn't you get cash?
both things happened.
Yeah. I think I can't remember the exact context of that quote from the book, but like, I think if he doesn't reference this specifically, like what I think of when I hear that quote is pandemic restrictions, mask mandates, and watching front of house at June's having to ask people to wear masks and then getting an earful from basically from belligerent customers who don't want to wear a mask. And like that was like,
yeah, that's a very new and present example of like clearly of what he's like talking about there.
Yes. But I think especially when he says I can't remember what when he says the word danger, I think that's what, like, that's kind of a COVID era thing, like that unruly customers can be so dangerous, like because they aren't
right
following health code.
I don't know. I think when he says danger, I think he's, I don't know. It read to me like an overarching meaning, like the societal dangers of, you know, the sustainability of the concept.
Right.
But like that, like what you're talking about mask mandates and front of house employees having to be the people who are enforcing them. Yeah. That puts a lot of force behind the word consent statement.
Yeah.
You know, like, because, you know, like you go to work with a certain understanding of safety and, you know, like you and your employer have hopefully agreed on the terms of, you know, what your work should look like, and you have given your consent to be put in that situation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if every second person you're talking to is like, you know, putting you in danger of getting sick, then, you know, you're not really able to control, you're not able to have any control over that agreement anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're like, immediately being pushed outside the bounds of your consent.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting. Do you have a copy of the book?
I have a Kindle copy of it. Yeah.
Cool. I wonder if there's an audio version of it.
Yeah, there is actually. No, there is.
There is. I'm pretty interested in checking it out. Actually, that sounds, I don't know. And he spoke at Cook's Camp.
Yeah, he was so it was Corey Mintz, and
he was
the moderator of a panel discussion. So he had he had input, and he would put questions to it was three restaurant owners. So yeah, he wasn't like the moderator in a presidential debate. He was like had a little bit more involvement than that.
Yeah,
And was able to.
And did it seem like he had a pretty like? I mean, I guess like I'm wondering if can someone write a book about the subject of changing the restaurant industry in North America to be more sustainable for small businesses and or like the employees that are involved in it and actually have like reasonable solutions to present. Like, I guess that's what I'm curious about.
How about we read it?
Like, did you feel like what's
how about we both read it and then have a episode about it
and then have a discussion about it? Yeah. I guess I'm just wondering what your impression of him from him being the moderator, like of that panel discussion was. Like, did it seem like he had good insights or did it seem like he's just like reaching blindly in the dark like everyone else?
He had good enough insights that I bought his book. his descriptions, his kind of history, he gave, I kind of touched on it in that, like talking about the day rates and the importing the fine dining pay structure to casual fine dining. Like that was a history that he laid out and put to the restaurant owners asking if they thought it was a fair assessment. They said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he like he worked in restaurants when he was younger, I think in Toronto, so he kind of understands the inside of the industry. He understands like how pay works for chefs, and that's what gave him credibility. Oh, he's very well spoken and everything, but like he seemed like he had the credibility that made me interested in the book. I really liked his histories and his descriptions of the current state. I don't actually fully know what his proposals are to correct or help with some of the issues, but this was the conversation where things like the charging more on holidays and taking deposits on reservations and those kinds of new costing models, new pricing models came up.
Well, I'm curious. Give me your impressions of the book when you start reading it, and I'm pretty interested in checking it out as well. Okay, Alan. can have been all existential nightmare fodder. There had to have been something fun that you did while you were out there camping with all the
chefs. No, there was loads of fun. The food was fantastic. It was like generally done on a large scale over coals, so there was like really fun stuff. Like they, Alex, Jen, and crew made paella in a paella pan that was probably 6 feet wide or something. Mm-hmm. And it had like, gooey duck and other like BC seafood in it. It was awesome.
Did it have saffron in it?
Yep, it did. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really paella, it's not saffron. But.
Lots of cooking over coals. They did a whole, like that, though, they, like I mentioned, they, one of the first sessions was a lamb slaughter, and that lamb got mm-hmm. cooked over coals whole, porchetta, whole halibut, like all these kind of big group kind of family meals that were really awesome. Oh, yeah, and that, the meal by the Haida Gwaii chef, Brody Swanson, was pretty mind-blowing. There was some pretty crazy preparations. There was one that was like a dish, and they just said like, this is kelp with I can't remember the fish now. It was something like, this is kelp with salmon roe on it. It might not have been salmon, but with some kind of fish roe on it.
Okay.
It was just like these squares of kelp with like with all this fish roe stuck to it, and it was mixed in a kind of like salad type preparation. And so you'd eat it and you get like the nice little pops, the little like bubble wrap kind of pops of the fish roe on seaweed. And then I asked one of the cooks later, I was like, so like, how do you adhere the roe to the seaweed? Like, oh no, like the fish lays the eggs on the seaweed and we harvest
on the roe and they
on this.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Which is,
that's crazy.
I felt stupid asking, but I didn't understand what it was.
Yeah. I mean, that's not what I thought. Yeah. I thought that they would like harvest roe and then, you know, cut out little pieces of seaweed and then like stick the, Wow. That's crazy.
And
that's amazing. I can't believe you got to eat that.
It was cool.
Wow.
And they had preparation, they called it soapberry. I meant to look into this actually. I'm pretty sure it's the same as in Alberta. We have something called buffalo berry, and it's edible, but when you eat it, it's like super, it's sour and it's very, very bitter. And I always knew that it was like, something that can be cooked with, but when I tasted it out of hand, I was like, I don't think I'll use
that. That I want to cook with.
Yeah. But they made, besides it being bitter, like you're able to froth it. So they made like it kind of looks like a reddish pink whipped cream. Eating it in that form, to me, it tasted exactly like Campari. So like very bitter and like red fruit kind of vibes. And it made mm-hmm. me really want to make a cocktail with it. So the next time I'm in the next time I'm around buffalo berry, I'd love to try and make a liqueur of it and see if you can make like a wild Campari kind of thing. But anyways, so yeah, the meals, the food was excellent. Those kind of culinary interest sessions were really great too. So did a foraging walk with the chef. Like I mentioned, the owner of Acadian sturgeon. Fascinating fish. Really tasty caviar. And honestly, it's just such a beautiful place.
Are those like farm-raised sturgeon in BC?
No. It's in Eastern Canada. And I believe, I should have double checked this. I think they definitely have some that are farmed, but I think they also do some wild sturgeon stuff. I'll have to double check. I'll have to fact check that.
Yeah. When you went on the foraging walk, what types of things were on the farmland there?
A lot of the stuff that was directly on the farm was similar to wild stuff you would find here. So horseradish, nettle, dandelion, obviously, plantain. Give me one second, actually.
Plantain?
Yeah, not that plantain. There's a there's a really common weed in Edmonton. Like you almost certainly have it on your in your yard, if not on your sorry. It's definitely on your street. Probably in your yard.
Oh man, if there's a weed and you have it grows here, it's in my yard.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah. But it looks like the leaves are quite broad. They grow out close to the ground, and then it has really distinctive, there's probably a specific botanical term I should know, but like really distinctive seed spikes that come out late in summer. Okay. I'll show you next time you're here. Yeah. But the leaves are, they're like spinachy, like they kind of have that like succulent, like thickness to them.
Gotcha.
But, and then the stuff that they were talking about that we don't have here, there's a berry called salal that I really want. That's the indigenous word for it. I don't know if there's a, like a okay. common English name for it, but kind of like sour blueberry vibes. That was really tasty.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what else on that foraging walk.
No mushrooms.
Not in the walk around the farm. Like obviously there's loads of mushrooms like in the woods around. We didn't come across any right. on the walk. Yeah. I'm blanking on other stuff now.
Yeah, fair. And did you participate in any cooking?
I observed a lot.
Yeah, like oh, you I did bring a knife with you? Or?
I had to fly. I did. I guess I did check a bag, so I could have brought a knife. But I packing and stuff was a scramble, so I didn't actually bring any knives or anything. But I did try and poke my nose in as much as I could and ask questions. Because like the indigenous stuff, like a lot of it, even knowing something about wild food in Alberta, like that was all completely new to me. And even the seafood, like whatever I've eaten, you can go for sushi in Edmonton, but like I'd never actually seen gooey duck prepared and
right.
Yeah. Okay. So it definitely hung around the tables and cooking pits and stuff to ask questions. But
that's cool. Did you make any new friends? Did you like talk to anybody who you're like, oh man, I should really go stage in your restaurant next year?
I definitely made some friends. Oh, one totally random story. one guy who I chatted with quite a bit. He was originally from BC. He went to Pika. I don't know if we've ever talked about. Do we ever talk about the Pacific Institute of Culinary Arts in like our cooking or a cooking school episode or anything?
I don't think so. Not directly.
Anyways, there was a lot of Pika alum there.
Okay.
But he now, this guy now lives in Kitchener.
Isn't Erica Pika?
She is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to visit. I had a few hours in Vancouver before my flight out, and I tried to go to Pika for a tour, but apparently it wasn't a good day for it. I've met in a few in Edmonton, but then working at Naramata in the summer, like met some grads of Pika, and it's like laid out so differently than Nate. And mm-hmm. seems like it's very effective. So I'm actually really curious to visit it. Anyways, that's another conversation.
That's another conversation.
Sorry, totally random. This guy now lives in Kitchener-Waterloo in Ontario.
Okay.
And we were like chatting and exchanging information and stuff. And he said, what's like, he knew I was Alan. He's like, what's your last name? I said, Sudaby. He said, oh yeah, Sudaby, which no one would ever, that's a weird, kind of a weird response to begin with, but it's also like not a very common name. And I was like, why did you just say that? And he said, oh, because my kids go to Sudaby school. I actually knew this, but had completely forgotten and might have gone the rest of my life without thinking about it. But in Kitchener-Waterloo, there's a school called, it might be called like the Jeremiah Sudaby School, but it's like a public school called the Sudaby School. And it was one of my, I'm a direct ancestor of his brother, James Sudaby.
Oh, crazy.
But it was just a random, like I'm positive that when I was a little kid, because I grew up like a couple hours away from there. I'm positive that my parents drove me by that school and said, check that.
That's the sodomy school.
Yeah. Anyways.
That's fun.
Sorry, random story.
Would you go again? Would you go back next year?
Yeah, I'd be curious to see. Because I hadn't heard of it before and hadn't followed it before, I'm curious to know how different the sessions are year over year. Yeah, but I would definitely recommend it. It's like, as an Albertan, you're a little bit of an outsider, but like, it's a pretty welcoming place. Right. Like everything in BC hospitality, it's all like very Vancouver facing, and like,
yeah,
Vancouver is like the juggernaut that's like churning out the talent and
right, and where the focus of all of the economics of the industry are.
Right.
And
but it's definitely like, it's a beautiful place. It was really welcoming and inclusive. There was loads of fascinating ideas. Got to meet lots of people with 5 times the experience that I have in the industry. It was great.
Cool. I mean, maybe next year we could go as a podcast and interview some people.
That's true.
I don't know.
Yeah.
One idea.
Okay. Who pays for that? Does Food Court pay for that? Corporation
comes out of it comes out of revenue from our merch sales.
Yeah. Wait a minute, from what sales?
Merch sales. Now we just got to come up with a great idea for a t-shirt.
Surely that's come up in a previous conversation, hasn't it?
I think so. I just don't think we have any good ideas. That's the only problem.
Oh no. Oh shoot. I'm thinking of the snail business and the plover egg business.
Yeah, I don't know if those are technically food court ventures, but
just a shirt that says "Got snails."
Done. We did it. Solved. One and done. Got snails. Just food court logo on the front. Got snails on the back.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sudeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.